Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, National Immigration Forum Call on Immigrants in Healthcare. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded, and I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Aldin Nourani. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. My name is Aldin Nourani. I'm president of the National Immigration Forum. And first and foremost, I hope that everybody and your families and your communities are safe and healthy. Truly appreciate you hopping on the phone today to join this conversation. And we're tremendously grateful for the speakers who are joining us today who are experts in the healthcare field, but more importantly, I would argue, practitioners in the healthcare field. I think in our time as a nation has the expertise, the commitment, and the courage of the healthcare workforce been more important. As COVID-19 continues to spread across the country, it is clearly posing an unprecedented challenge to the nation's healthcare system. Hospitals and medical facilities are nearing or over capacity, with the virus still continuing to move across the nation, whether it's in the hotspots that we're seeing on the East Coast or what we're beginning to see in other parts of the country. Immigrants, along with U.S. citizens who may have been here for whose families have been here for generations, are on the front lines of this pandemic, representing an indispensable part of America's healthcare workforce. In fact, when we're looking specifically at the immigrants of the foreign-born workforce, immigrants are 17% of the healthcare workforce overall, 24% of 24% of direct care workers, such as nursing, psychiatric, and home health aides, and 28% of highly skilled professionals, such as physicians and surgeons. And when we look more specifically at the coronavirus hotspots, such as New York or New Jersey, 29% of nurses are immigrants. And as our population continues to, as we look forward past hopefully a time when we're not contending with a pandemic such as this, we also have to be ready for the next pandemic and the next crisis, in which case it's increasingly clear that we will depend on the talents, the skills, the courage, and commitment of immigrants and refugees in our healthcare workforce. We're here today to talk about what folks are seeing on the ground, but also what are the healthcare workforce needs when it comes to immigrants and immigration. To get us started, I want to turn the conversation over to Jacinta Ma, our the Forum's Vice President of Policy and Advocacy. Jacinta.
Thanks, Ali. I'm Jacinta Ma, the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at the National Immigration Forum. As we continue to combat this public health emergency, America's number one priority should be maintaining a stable workforce of qualified healthcare professionals. Shortages in the healthcare workforce have been an ongoing problem, particularly in rural areas and for underserved populations. This current crisis shows how important it is to fill those shortages and the important role that immigrants play in doing that. The administration must act as quickly as possible to remove immigration-related barriers for medical professionals by ensuring that immigrant doctors, nurses, home health care workers, researchers, and others can continue to play a vital frontline role during this pandemic, while at the same time being afforded adequate protection from COVID-19. Specifically, the National Immigration Forum asks the administration and Congress to move immediately to continue processing worker visas, suspend or extend immigration-related deadlines, and provide flexibility so that healthcare and other workers are not penalized for being unable to meet the terms of their visas due to circumstances surrounding COVID-19. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacinta. Our next speaker is Frank Trinity. He's the Chief Legal Officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges. Frank.
Thanks, Bobby. The Association of American Medical Colleges represents the nation's medical schools and teaching hospitals, many of which are on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. As Jacinta said, we have a shortage of physicians in the U.S., and for decades, we have relied on physicians from other countries especially in medically underserved areas. For this reason, even before the pandemic, we've advocated for an immigration system that is fair, predictable, and efficient. The outcome of the pandemic will depend in part on whether the surge of patients outstrips our physician workforce. We see five actions the administration can take right now to ensure that physicians and other health professionals from other countries can continue their heroic work. First, the administration should approve a blanket extension of visa deadlines for anyone involved in the fight to save lives. Second, the administration should prioritize and expedite processing of visa applications, extensions, changes of status, and the like, including reinstatement of premium processing for physicians and H-1B status. Third, because visas were approved in a pre-pandemic era, they're typically limited to a particular program or hospital. The administration should now provide flexibility to visa sponsors during this emergency so that they can redeploy health professionals where they're needed most. For example, elsewhere within a sponsor's health system or through a telehealth arrangement. Fourth, the administration should take every possible action to streamline the entry of 4,200 physicians from other countries who matched last month to U.S. residency programs so that they can begin residency on July 1st. Fifth, and separate from the visa issues I just mentioned, the administration should maintain work authorization for the more than 29,000 DACA recipients who are vital members of our healthcare workforce. I'll just sum up by saying, with an unprecedented number of desperately ill patients needing emergency care all across the country, now is the time for our government to take every possible action to ensure that these highly qualified and courageous health professionals are available in the fight against the coronavirus. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Our next speaker is Sister Jacqueline McCarthy, Director of Bethany Healthcare Center in Framingham, Massachusetts. Sister Jacqueline.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. I am Sister Jacqueline McCarthy, the CEO and Administrator of Bethany Healthcare Center, 169-bed skilled nursing facility in Framingham, Massachusetts. At Bethany Healthcare Center, we depend every day on the hard work of Haitian immigrants, who not only make up more than 6% of our workforce, but are also our friends, our colleagues, and our neighbors. Massachusetts is facing a shortage of qualified nursing aides. And as we fight the coronavirus pandemic, our facility cannot afford to lose dependable staff. If we did, we could not replace them. That's why the government must expand temporary protective status for the tens of thousands of Haitians and other immigrants currently living in the United States. If the TPS program is allowed to expire, our facility will immediately lose essential healthcare workers in the midst of a pandemic, putting the safety of our elders and all of the frail residents here in Massachusetts at great risk. We depend so much on the Haitian population who plays such a vital role here. I don't know what I would do if they're not able to be here with us.
Thank you, Sister Jacqueline. Thank you. Our next speaker is Edison Suasnavas, a molecular oncology specialist and DACA recipient. Edison.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me join. It's really an honor to be here with you guys. Just to let you know a little bit more about me, I've been here in the U.S. For about 20 years. I moved from Quito, Ecuador when I was 13 years old. And as you mentioned, I'm a DACA recipient. Before DACA, I had the blessing to obtain full-ride scholarships to Utah State University, where I was able to obtain two bachelors, one in biology, one in biotechnology, and a master's degree in animal science with an emphasis in molecular biology. It was a great time going to school because I was able to defend a thesis and type some publications. But during the time I was doing this, President Obama passed DACA, and I had the opportunity to transition from a research field into the clinical field. That it's a little bit different going to a clinical area from a research one. Currently, I work in ARUP laboratories. I've been there since DACA passed. I've been working there for 7 years. And I'm a specialist in the molecular oncology laboratory, currently holding a molecular biology ASCP certification and a New York approved certification to be able to process samples nationwide for patients with cancer. I pretty much perform the same role as a medical technologist, which we work closely with pathologists, aiding in the detection of different type of cancer mutations, from leukemia to aggressive glioblastomas. And I don't know if you guys have heard, but currently there's a shortage of medical technologies in the country. And sadly, because of the coronavirus crisis, my company stopped hiring more technologies. I know in the past that President Trump has mentioned that more healthcare workers are needed from out of the country that speak good English and have years of experience in the field. However, there are 27,000 DACA recipients currently aiding in the healthcare force, especially now with in the pandemic. So I ask myself, why look out of the country for these professionals when you already have them here speaking the language and with the right professional skill experience to perform the right job, and especially professionals that love the country as if we were born here. I think the U.S. needs us more than ever. And also, the reason why I decided to join was because now more than ever, it is really important to process the cancer patient samples as fast as possible because they're more vulnerable with an immunocompromised system in front of the current virus. So thank you so much for having me here.
Edison, thank you so much for joining. Our final speaker today is Dr. Amit Vashis. He's Senior Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer at Ballot Health, and he's a member of the Public Policy Committee of the Society of Hospital Medicine. Dr. Vashis, thank you.
Thank you, Ali, and I would like to thank the National Immigration Forum, as well as the Society of Hospital Medicine and its Public Policy Committee for asking me to participate in this call. This issue is obviously very important to me. I have been an immigrant myself, went through the visa journey and the permanent residency journey a few years ago, so there is a lot of personal experience to it. And I'm just honored to be here. Let me tell you, you know, I do serve as a chief clinical officer, senior vice president for my health system, Ballot Health. It is a 21 health system serving patients in a very tough part of the country, the southern Appalachia, an underserved part of the country, southwest Virginia and northeast Tennessee. We rely on a lot of international doctors, international nursing to serve our communities. That's how I got started in my career. As I said, I also serve on the Public Policy Committee of the Society of Hospital Medicine. Before I go any further, let me tell you what hospitalists do. Basically, we are clinicians whose professional focus is the care of hospitalized patients. And we are one of the frontline main specialties of providers during this COVID-19 pandemic. Hospitalists, they are and will be the primary attending physicians who are directly responsible for large majority of the patients who are hospitalized with the COVID-19 condition. Wanted to also go ahead and talk about immigrant physicians. of course, long before COVID-19, we have been facing a huge physician shortage in the United States. Multiple solutions have come up, including comprehensive immigration reform. But one thing that is not disputed is that immigrant physicians have been absolutely critical to providing quality care, especially these times on the front lines of the coronavirus epidemic. Current visa restrictions have limited the ability to deploy these immigrant physicians in communities with the greatest needs. Federal agencies and Congress, I believe, should provide additional flexibility in visa processing to allow for automatic renewals and expedited processing so immigrant medical workers, including doctors, nurses, they can focus on treating the sick. Let them focus on treating the sick and not focus at this point of time on their visa requirements and stipulations. For example, physicians who are currently on an H-1B visa, they're only currently allowed to work at the hospital site that is specified on their visa. As everyone on this call is aware, no matter which news source you go to, there have been calls for help by Governor Cuomo, Gavin Newsom from New York and California, respectively. They are calling for physicians from out of state to come and help them take care of these patients. And, medical schools are graduating students early. Retired physicians are being pulled out of action. But let me tell you, there are tens of thousands of immigrant physicians who, if freed from their visa stipulation, can go in there and help these communities at their greatest hour of need. That's why I feel the administration should immediately allow clinicians on H-1B visas to work in the hospitals that have not sponsored their visas. There are also more than 100,000 United States-trained international medical graduates. They are stuck currently in the green card backlog. They are, as a result of that, unable to assist in the COVID-19 fight outside their work site. Now, keep in mind, if each of these physicians were able to work just one extra day in these locations where we have the greatest need, New Jersey, California, New York, Washington State, in the United States, you would have an extra 10,000 physician days available to fight the pandemic. And so our request is that these doctors who have been stuck in the green card quagmire for a long, long time should be immediately given permanent residency status or green cards, and that will drastically boost the flexibility of our healthcare workforce in this time of need. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Vashist. Amiki, can you please provide the instructions for questions, please?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone.
And I just want to reiterate the request of the administration, the urgent request that we're making of the administration today. Many of our speakers got into different details of this request, but we believe the administration must act quickly as possible to protect and remove immigration-related barriers for immigrant medical professionals, whether folks are here as H-1B recipients serving as doctors or nurses, or TPS recipients working in healthcare, or DACA recipients who are, as Edison, on the front lines of research, or so many others across the healthcare field. So can we open this up to the questions, please?
We're asking participants to only ask one question, and if they have a follow-up, they can repress star one. And our first question comes from Mara Sacchetti with The Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, I just hope everybody's safe and well. I had a question for Edison, just a quick one. But I wanted to ask how old you are and where you live now.
Currently, I'm 33 years old, and I live in Saratoga Springs, Utah.
Okay, in Utah?
Yes.
And pardon me, how old were you when you came to the United States?
I was 13.
13. Thanks, Edison.
No, thank you.
And our next question comes from Mihar Patel with Balad Health. Your line is open.
Yeah, I would like to ask this question for anybody who has answered. I'm myself a hospitalist too, and my main concern is that even though I'm on H-1B for the last 10-15 years due to countrywide gap on the green card, even being a physician in the front line. My concern is if something happens to the physician while working in the front line, their dependent family, who are also on the dependent visa, they would be deported. They would not even be protected in the country, but they would be deported, and then nothing else. So anybody can answer about that. What anybody has any issues or faced anything?
Great. Well, thank you. And I'm going to turn this over to Jacinta. But we'd also ask that folks who are on the line who are not pressed, if you wouldn't mind kind of holding off on questions and maybe emailing us if you have questions, we can answer them, but wanted to prioritize press. But Jacinta, go ahead, please.
Yes, that's true. I mean, people who are here on visas and they're sponsored, their dependent visa is sponsored, they do not have recourse should something happen to the primary visa holder. There are certain exceptions, for instance, in the military, for instance, some family members have the ability to continue to be processed if their family member dies. But, those are the terms of the visas.
Can I add one thing? This is Dr. Vishy.
Please.
Yeah. I think, Jacinta, you made an excellent point. And one of the things is the military. If you serve the United States in the Army, you get expedited processing of your permanent residency, and your family most likely is taken care of in the unfortunate event that you are deceased. A few days ago, President Trump mentioned something that really captured my attention. He described the COVID-19 pandemic as a war. That was actually one thing I agreed with President Trump. So if we are fighting a war, healthcare workers are the front lines, including our nurses, physicians, everybody. Of course, we have asked for adequate ammunition, PPE, all those kind of things. I think it is also justified to ask when many of these immigrant frontline healthcare providers are going to be exposing themselves to this deadly virus, taking care of our community's patients and everybody. They have no qualms about doing it. I think the administration should have a really compassionate view. This is no less than serving in an Iraq or Afghanistan. The only difference is it's happening within our own communities at this point of time. So you make an excellent point, Dr. Patel.
Our next question comes from America Arias with CNN. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Hopefully you guys can hear me. My question is, how are you as an organization, or maybe with your allies, either lawmakers or somebody who can actually get legislation passed, how prepared are you for the possibility of the Supreme Court striking down DACA? Obviously, this would impact a lot of people, but right now with the health crisis that we're dealing with, how would you take action to protect and help the 27,000 DACA recipients who are in the medical field helping with this health situation?
Sure. Thank you. And Edison, I'll turn this to you. And I guess I would just say, this is Ali from the get-go, that I think it's imperative that those who are DACA recipients who are eligible for renewal renew their status immediately and in essence kind of get that next 2-year window. But Edison, would love to get your perspective on this.
For sure, as a dreamer, it's really hard to deal with the anxiety that we have right now and the stress, not only to have been fighting with the current pandemic, but also on top of that, just seeing when the Supreme Court decides to rule on DACA, right? That's why one of the main reasons I decided to participate in different interviews and in meetings like this one, because I just hope that somehow that message gets to the judge's heart, because now we're depending on the decision from 9 judges, right? So I hope like they can see, like as the doctor mentioned, that this is not different than going to fight in a war. Like we're currently fighting side by side with American citizens in a war with an enemy that we cannot see. But the difference now is, like, as the doctor said, instead of guns, our guns are the PPE equipment, right? So I hope, like, the judges and people in Congress, especially the president, like, puts more attention to people like me that are going to work just for the purpose of helping patients, no matter where those patients, how those patients look, or no matter what political preference they have. When you get a sample in your hands, you don't care about those things. You just want to release the result as soon as possible so that the patients get better as soon as possible, get on an early treatment, because an early diagnosis can save a life. So I think it's really hard to deal with, but I just hope, like, as we share our stories, the political people in Washington really make a fair decision that at the end we didn't do anything wrong. Most of the situations, we didn't even decide to come to the country, but we decide to give back to the country as much as we can with our knowledge in our careers, because this is the country that gave us our education, that gave us everything that we have, you know. So, and we learn to love it as well as we live here. So I just hope, like, somehow the message gets across and they give us the opportunity to keep showing how much we love this country.
This is Frank.
Mr. Jackman, if I could.
Can I add a couple
of things? Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
So if the president prevails in the Supreme Court on the legal question, number one, we would hope that the president, given the circumstances, would reconsider the rescission of the work authorization and come up with a different plan so that the health professionals and other individuals who are vital to the response would not lose their work reauthorization. Ultimately, though, Congress is the body that can resolve the legal status of individuals with DACA status. And I would note that there's a bill called the American Dream and Promise Act of 2019 in the House, and then there's the DREAM Act of 2019 in the Senate. Each of those bills would provide a pathway to citizenship for DACA recipients. So those are the two points I wanted to make on the scenario that was presented.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Frank. And then, Sister Jacqueline, from your perspective on this question, whether it is somebody who's working at Bethany Health who is a DACA recipient or a TPS recipient, What does that mean to the care that the center is able to provide should they lose that status?
Well, first of all, let me say we've talked a lot about caregivers, doctors, maybe nurses. But in my building, I depend on other people who are DACA recipients. And those are the people who work in the dietary department, those who work in the laundry, those who work in housekeeping. So we're not just talking about, you know, a few number of people. We're talking about a large number of people who I couldn't replace because, sad to say, many people in the United States would prefer to do other things than to work, you know, in housekeeping or dietary. And so I really don't know what would happen. We would lose a tremendous number of our workers. And these workers, they've been with us a number of years, and they're tremendous people. And it just makes me feel so sad that I can't really do much to protect them except to work through, you know, the advocacies, the lines of advocacy that I have available to me. But I'm saddened by all of this because, unlike the others on the call, I think the loss would be far greater for us because of all the ancillary people.
Thank you, Sister Jacqueline. Would anybody else like to add something to this particular question before we move on? Great, thank you. Can we get the next question, please?
And we have a follow-up from Mara Cerchetti with The Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks again. Edison, could you please tell us a little bit more about how are you working on the front line of the COVID-19 response? I mean, are you in a hospital? Can you tell us just a little bit more, please, about your exposure to it and what exactly it is that you do related to it? Thank you.
Yes, of course. Right now I work in different, well, the company I work has different clinical laboratories. Right now, I'm currently working in the molecular oncology laboratory, which we primarily aid with the detection of cancer. The lab that's right next to us, molecular infectious disease, they're the ones directly involved with the coronavirus detection. So right now, as the tests keep increasing, they have asked that eventually, since we have the background knowledge in molecular biology, eventually there's a potential we're going to help with the, it can be the extraction of the RNA of the samples or with either the analysis or even releasing the results to the patients. Since inside my company, the test gets done in 24 hours for now. So there's a potential that I'm going to be helping the lab soon. Since we have the knowledge inside the molecular biology technique, specifically the RT-PCR technique. So right now, I'm still helping like cancer patients. As I mentioned before, it's not less important that the coronavirus patients, because some people don't know that they have cancer. So the quicker you release those results to them, the better they can protect from this virus, since, as I mentioned, they're already in an immunocompromised system. So there's that potential that as more hands are needed for help, they're going to start like taking some people from my lab to help with the detection of the coronavirus testing.
Thank you, Edison. Operator, would you mind re-prompting for the questions, please?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, we're asking participants to only ask one question. And you can repress star one if you would like to do a follow-up. One moment
while we're waiting. While we're waiting for them to re-queue, Dr. Bashista, I was wondering if you might be able to speak to, in essence, what Sister Jacqueline started to bring up in terms of just the range of skills that are necessary within the healthcare workforce, whether it's from the hospitals that you work in to the nursing homes, and how immigrants play a role in that skill set.
Well, immigrant healthcare workers span across all realms, and they are well represented even in this call. I can speak on behalf of the healthcare workers that are part of my organization. My organization has about 17,000, 18,000 caregivers, other word for healthcare workers. And that includes physicians, nursing, respiratory therapists, physical therapists, cafeteria workers, so on and so, environmental services. As far as the immigrant aspect of healthcare workers is concerned, they are primarily in my community, in the hospitalist workforce, in the hospital physicians, which include the hospitalist, the generalist, as well as the specialist, and of course the nursing staff, where we have a lot of international nursing that is present. As far as the capabilities are concerned, the profession that I'm dual boarded in internal medicine, practice clinically as a hospitalist. I'm also a psychiatrist. As a hospitalist, we take care of patients right from admitting them from the ER or taking them as a transfer from other hospitals all the way up to post-acute care, which is your nursing facilities and everything. If those patients crash, if need be, we are the ones who will put the patient on ventilator, call the intensivist, if some procedures need to be done, basic procedures on those patients. So we span the entire domain of the patient care continuum. And a lot of my physician force that I represent and lead in my health system are immigrants. They are on visas. And as I said before, this is a war with an invisible enemy. Many of my folks, I speak with them almost every day, want to check on them, how they're doing psychologically is. And some of the personal stories that I hear is, I'm starting my clinical shift starting tomorrow. I just worry about my wife and kids, man. What's going to happen in case, we have had a few caregivers who have been afflicted with the coronavirus, including one of our physician leaders, Ali, who is on a ventilator as we speak. And so these caregivers and physicians, they worry if something were to happen to them, who's going to take care of their families? This is, someone says, this is not a sprint. This is not a marathon. And my request to the administration is, please don't let us run this marathon or a sprint, whatever you may consider, with one of our legs tied. Give us all the support tools. PPE is one tool, but peace of mind is another tool that me and my family will be taking care of regardless of my immigrant status because of what I have to offer and what I will continue to offer to the American society. I know this is a long answer, but some of it also spans some of my emotional feelings that I've gone through the last few days watching some of these wonderful caregivers take care of our communities and patients, Ali.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Bashist. Before we wrap up, Frank, Sister Jacqueline, Edison, or Jacinta, any final words? Let me start with you, Frank.
Thanks, Ali, and thanks, everybody, for your contribution today. I just wanted to give a couple examples of the administration has actually approved some flexibility, and I think these are good examples, and what we need is more of this. So medical residents are approved for a particular residency program, which might be tied to a particular hospital. And HHS, about a week and a half ago, issued guidance that medical residents could practice at a different location or even over telehealth in response to the COVID emergency. So that's one example of flexibility that the administration approved. Secondly, J-1 visa holders, physicians, they are also tied to a particular location during their J-1 status. And the State Department actually issued guidance to the sponsor of all J-1s that during the emergency, they too could practice at another location, say at a different hospital within the health system. So we've seen some flexibility from the administration. We need that to be exercised more broadly, in particular with the H-1B physicians, that we need USCIS and the Department of Labor to essentially look for ways that they could eliminate constraints on flexibility for these practicing physicians during this emergency.
Thank you, Frank. Sister Jacqueline, any final words on your end?
You know, I have 169 residents. We have many, many dreamers. Our residents have developed strong relationships with them. And I will tell you right now, there would be some psychological issues if all of a sudden some of these people or all of these people just disappeared. It would be a terrible, terrible thing. You know, the residents I have are all elderly. They love our workers. They have relationships. And I can't imagine how the residents would feel if all of a sudden I had to say to them, well, they couldn't be here anymore. So it's very personal to me. I'm a sister of St. Joseph. We have a whole office that's working just on immigration. We're teaching English as a second language. We're helping people to get their green cards. But it just makes me sad to think that this is happening in the ramifications in my little corner of the world, which I understand listening to the others, is not as grand as they are involved in. But to me, it's extraordinarily important. And I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be able to share with others.
Thank you, Sister Jacqueline. Framingham is the most important place, in my humble opinion. Edison, any final words on your end, your part?
Yes, thank you so much once again for having me and listening to what I have to say, not only as performing the role currently of a medical technologist, but as my feelings as a DACA recipient. I think the U.S., as I mentioned, needs us more than ever right now. Imagine taking away those 27,000 DACA health workers currently helping to fight this pandemic, or the 200,000 DACA recipients that not only helping in healthcare, but driving trucks at stores, and not counting the immigrants that, for example, right now pick up like fruit, vegetables for us. You know, in this time of crisis, like it's easy, like, well, it's not so easy anymore because we're scared, but you go to the store and you still find fruit, you still find vegetables, things like that, but you don't think what's behind that, right? Who are the immigrants and farm workers that made that available for us? It's the same from, like, medical technology's point of view. Like, you go to the doctor, give your sample, and you expect your sample as soon as possible, but you don't think who's behind, who's processing that sample for you. And that's the role that we play here. So, as I said, like, I just hope, like, people in Washington see this, what we're doing for the country. There have been reporters that have asked me, well, if you have so much experience on not only the research field, but now in the clinical field, how come you don't go find opportunities in another country? And all I can say is, like, it's hard to leave what you love. And even though it has been 20 years of waiting for an opportunity to show my potential and what I can keep achieving in the country, in those 20 years, I learned to love this country as much as the place that I was born. And I will say even more because this is where I obtained my education. This is where I met my wife, where I had my kids, where I had the blessing to buy, like, my first home. So all those things let you have the hope. And I keep praying every night that they value our potential to keep contributing to the country that now we call home.
Thank you, Edison. And then, Jacinta, any closing comments on your end, please?
You know, just to say that I think from all of everybody's comments, we can tell just how important immigrants are in our workforce, in our communities, and, you know, just to people personally in their personal relationships, and that Congress and the administration all have an opportunity to implement solutions that will make it so that immigrants can continue to contribute and that they are able to stay in the United States and help us make our country even better.
Thank you. And I want to thank Frank Trinity with the Association of American Medical Colleges, Sister Jacqueline McCarthy with Bethany Healthcare in Framingham, Dr. Amit Vashist, a member of the Public Policy Committee of the Society of Hospital Medicine, and Edison Svasnavas, a molecular oncology specialist and DACA recipient. Please feel free to follow up with the Forum Press team for further questions. We'll be sending a statement out shortly along with a recording of the call. But again, to our panelists, thank you for joining. Thank you for everything that you are doing. And to those who joined, thank you for the time. And please, everybody, stay safe and stay healthy. Thank you.